Of all the drivers in Formula One's long history, none of them has a story quite like Perry McCarthy.
There was a call from Eddie Jordan's solicitor, a guy called Fred Rogers, lovely guy. And Fred said, "Hello, Perry." He said, "I've got a question for you." So I said, "Yeah." He said, "How would you like to be a Formula One driver?"
That call put Perry on track for a crazy ride, driving for statistically one of the worst teams in the 75-year history of the Formula One World Championship. He never raced. He never even qualified.
I've pulled out of the garage. I've got to the line. They've gone, go! And I've gone across the line and the engine's cut out. As soon as I came into Formula One, I would set records. I told everybody that, and I did. The shortest ever attempt at qualifying for a Grand Prix.
Perry went from oil rig worker to F1 driver to the mysterious black race-suited Stig on TV's Top Gear. He definitely didn't take the normal racing line. I'm Tom Clarkson, and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid. It's incredible to look back at the early 90s and think how far the sport has come since then. The team Perry McCarthy drove for, Andrea Moda, simply couldn't be in F1 today. Their single season in 1992 was chaotic. In France, their trucks didn't turn up at the racetrack in time. In Canada, the cars arrived, but their engines didn't. In Brazil, the first race of the year, Perry's superlicense was found to be invalid, so he couldn't drive. When Andrea Moda did get out on track, the car either broke down or was too slow. Perry got knocked out in an extra pre-qualifying session on 5 occasions. He never lined up on the grid for a Grand Prix. The team is an amazing example of how not to do Formula One. But Perry's determination to make it as a driver is admirable. For someone to go from working on an oil rig in the middle of the North Sea to racing alongside the likes of Damon Hill is an incredible achievement. Perry gives one of the most eye-opening accounts you'll ever hear of a bygone era in Formula One. I hope you enjoy it. Perry, it's great to have you on the show. Thank you for your time. How are you?
Flat out. Absolutely flat out. Enjoying what I'm trying to do as always and doing the best I can.
And do you still watch Formula One closely today?
Oh, absolutely. You know, whatever time in the morning it might start from an international race. I'm the guy sitting on the edge of the seat. The heart beats up. I'm looking at the red lights and I'm the amount of times I've jumped the start, Tom, it's unbelievable. No, when I've been looking at it, I'll just sit there thinking, wow, come on. It's so exciting, you know?
How different is F1 today compared to the early 90s when you were involved?
You know, back in the early 90s, you'd look at the absolute top teams, really, as far as organization, presentation, everything else, probably McLaren Williams, you know. And you'd think, how can anybody get more precise than this, more professional than this? How is it possible? It is incredible how the sport has grown from a collection of talent, the amount of people involved in the teams now, the lengths they go to on understanding their engineering design, the assembly, the fabrication, the transportation. It's far more data-led than it ever was, of course. The level of sophistication, that's probably the word I was looking for, has increased exponentially.
Do you think the drivers have evolved as well?
Massively. You know, you're always going to have your absolute standouts like Ayrton or Alan or whatever that took things to their limits, and obviously a tiny bit later, Michael, you know, Schumacher, etc. But the drivers now, I'll include myself to a small degree on this, obviously. My achievements in F1 were like zero compared to everybody I'm mentioning. But you have to have some kind of engineering understanding. You want to have, as Nicky used to put it, a sensitive backside. You know, you've got to be able to feel it. You've got to be able to communicate that to your engineer and try and make the right decisions. But what the drivers are faced with now is that there's a steering wheel which makes a PlayStation look easy, you know, which they're using at 200 miles an hour. So their understanding of the processes, the engineering side of things, the amount of times they spend in debriefs, they are way more engineering driven. And I think the relationship between the teams and the driver, especially when on the track, is one of the things that's changed the most.
Look, let's talk about your driving career now.
That's not going to take long.
you tested for front-running Formula One teams and you tried to qualify the Andrea Moda in 1992. You didn't start a Grand Prix. Do you look back on that period and feel hard done by?
That's an expression that I've never actually used, and it's probably been to my benefit. I've never actually used that or felt that. I always look at everything as an opportunity and just feel, look, here's what I've got to give. And if it doesn't work, I can't do a bloody thing about that. So the Andrea Moda thing was a bit embarrassing because I'd come straight from the States and I was leading most of the races I was in.
That's in sports cars.
They were quick cars, the Le Mans cars, and I was up against the works Jaguars, the works Porsches, the works Toyotas, the works Nissan team. And we were with this tiny little team, the Spice with a Chevy engine. But we kept taking care of the others, you know, to a large degree. I mean, we rarely finished because we had no budget. The engine would pop or the clutch would go or whatever. But it was fantastic driving to that limit. Then to come into Formula One thinking, what I'd done in Formula 3000, what I've done in America, you know, let me off the leash in Formula One, here we go. But of course, we were so far off the pace when we even were running. I could not make up that difference. That's the thing in motor racing, is that when you win, you don't have to explain very much. But when you're at the back of the grid or not even qualifying, you're looked at, understandably, as if you're some kind of muppet at the back of the field who should never have been there in the first place. But honestly, I don't like the expression. I don't see things as being hard done by. I mean, you know, with my background, even getting to Formula One was kind of, wow. You know, from working on the oil rigs and out there for 2.5 years in freezing conditions, dreaming of being a racing driver and dreaming of getting to Formula One and then making it against the odds, you kind of think, okay, that dream wasn't enough. There is the next step. I'm competitive. I want to show I'm one of the fastest out there. But that bit just didn't happen.
Can we just look into your background and ask why Formula One for you? You mentioned the oil rigs. Is there any racing in your family? Why did you want to become a racing driver?
You know, I was really no good at football and rugby and cricket and everything else, but I'm still a competitive guy, you know, but I was just no good at all those sports. But as soon as I got in a road car, suddenly I found I could do loads of different things, you know, going into a roundabout sideways or around a corner sideways or spin a car even on the straight and stuff like that. I got to know a lot of the local police like that as well. It had benefits, communication benefits. But word got around about my driving, and the chief instructor of Brands Hatch Racing, he actually came out to find me and said, I keep hearing about you. I've come out to get you. And I took him around the track and he said, let me show you what I can do. This guy must have been about 65 years old. Seriously, about 65. He took me around the track and showed me what somebody who was really good could do. Yeah, and he was talking to me at the same time. And I thought, this bloke's lost his mind. You know, how can he go this fast? And he's 65. He's going to have a heart attack. We're all going to die, you know? But anyway, he said, look, I've seen something in you. Get back in and do that. And I did. And I did about 3-4 laps. That was it. He dragged me out of the car and just said, I think you've gone faster than I've ever gone. That was quite literally it. And he took me straight away to see the circuit owners. All of a sudden, while we was up there, Bernie Ecclestone was there. And he went straight up to Bernie and said, this bloke's going to Formula One. And he explained a bit about my background. And Bernie looked at me and said, son, you got no money. You got no experience. Your family's got no money. Your chances of making a Formula One are about 1,000,000 to 1. And every time I tell her that story, I sound more and more like Michael Caine. And I was just thinking, I'm just standing there thinking, wow, I've just met Bernie Ecclestone. I wasn't out to prove
to
anyone.
And was it deflating that the boss of Formula One at the time was telling you you weren't going
to
make it?
It meant nothing to me. But do you know why it meant nothing to me? Because I wasn't bright enough to understand that he was probably right.
How old were you at this time?
I was 18, yeah.
So you're starting late compared to all the other people coming into racing.
I started even later because one of the things I found out rapidly was that motor racing requires money. Yeah, in the States, with the NASA program, they used to have to go to Congress for their budget. They had a great expression, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. Well, I developed one fairly quickly, no Sterling, no Sterling Moss. So it's a question of you need money to come in, and I didn't have it. So I went to work on the North Sea rigs, which was really horrible.
Tell us more, what was that like? What was your job?
Well, if you leave any metal structure in the sea long enough, it will corrode. and then structurally at a foul. So there was a corrosion control program where you would shot blast all the rubbish and spray and the rust off it and the old painting system off it to then recoat it to protect the metal. To do that, you've got to scaffold the entire area to be able to get to it. So while you're doing that, you're kind of dodging the waves. With the upper areas, such as the heli decks, of course, you're 120, 130 foot above the sea. After 3 weeks, I started throwing bread to the helicopter saying, take me with you, birdie, please, now, just get me out of here. It was horrible, but it was the solution. That was going to earn me my start money. And then, of course, coming in, it was literally, I was 21 by the time I actually got on track. So there was 2.5 years of being out there dreaming. This is after my bunch of laps that I did with Les Ager at Brands Hatch. It was definitely set in stone for me to say, okay. And at the same time, I was watching Formula One on TV and stuff and just thinking, I was in love with these guys, with the cars, with the excitement, that daredevil kind of, wow, this is fantastic, you know? All I've got to do is be able to drive at the same speed and I can do this. I can go out and try and win races.
And so when you do get racing, you actually are very successful in Formula Ford, but you also have some big crashes. You broke your back early on in 1984. Did that make you question your choice of career?
No, not at all. No.
Did it knock your confidence?
No, that didn't knock my confidence whatsoever. I'm not unique here. It's that there's been a whole bunch of racing drivers who have got fairly seriously hurt and come back. You know, I think that what it was beginning to show was that there were quite a lot of attributes I had which seemed to fit with the requirements of motor racing. I think that's the best way I can put it. Where I was a little bit light was experience, obviously. Where I was definitely light was intelligence. You know, there was everything was taking around the outside, go down the inside. Where's the big move? Oh, I'm in the wall. You know, it's just so because I didn't have that karting background to get all that out of my system. Sometimes I was making these mistakes at a critical moment, but I did get that out of my system fairly quickly. And then, yeah, I then won the British Championship. That was great. But then had the big crash and then come back. But the drive was, Tom, the drive was to make progress. The drive was desperately to make progress. I was beginning to get a little bit older, stating the obvious, and I was beginning to say, I've got to get to Formula One, but I still need to get into Formula 3 yet. I still need to get into what we call then Formula 3000, which is, of course, Formula 2 now. I still need to get an F1 drive. So that burning ambition was something that was inside me every day of the week. How can I be better? How can I be faster? But I'm not sure I made all the right decisions anyway, because no experience. One of the benefits that many of the successful drivers have around them and have had around them in their junior career is brighter people making great considered decisions on how to steer their career. Me, it was walking around industrial estates, knocking on doors, trying to chat anybody up to get another $500 for next weekend's race. Yeah, that was my life, trying to stay in play and trying to do something when I was.
But the late 80s, early 90s was a halcyon period for Brits,
yeah,
in Formula One. You had Mansell winning the title in 92, knocking on the door many times before. Did that help you raise money? The sort of almost like the status of Formula One was so high back then.
No, it really didn't. Maybe I was approaching the wrong people. All it did for me was to, you know, I was probably getting a bit better about how to introduce the benefits of backing me. And even that was failing miserably. You know, there was so much rejection. I guarantee you.
How did you deal with the rejection?
Well, you have to bring a barrier down. But I mean, I understand the word no in 27 different languages. But you just keep going. If you can't deal with the rejection, then it's going to happen. So you might as well quit. You won't get through it. Here's a life lesson, everybody, from Perry McCarthy. Rejection makes you think about another approach. How can I get accepted? How can I get what I want? What is there a different way to go about this? Am I being stupid? Do I need other people? Can I get more of a team around me? What can make what I'm trying to achieve better for other people to come in to help me, for me to help them? That's driven by rejection. You don't have to keep thinking about things if you're successful immediately and carry on being successful. You've already got it taped.
Did you get any support, any advice from the other Brits at the time? You were part of the British Rat Pack, right? And I'm thinking of Damon Hill, Mark Blundell, Julian Bailey, Johnny Herbert. You were as thick as thieves.
And Marty Donnelly. Yeah.
And of course, Donnelly.
Yeah.
Did you guys sort of discuss ways forward, or were you actually mates, but actually the first person you wanted to beat was one of the Rat Pack?
We were all very good mates. That was quite incredible. And you know, I tell you something, I actually very, very rarely use the word proud. I'm proud of this, or I'm proud of that, because I'm not. I expect it. If I've won a race or if I set pole position, I don't turn around and say, I was proud of that. I expect it. I seriously do. But I guess I am actually proud about our little Rat Pack, because it was a real tight-knit thing where, yeah, I think we did think about each other. But as far as advice was concerned, no, I don't really think so. I mean, I wasn't predisposed to start telling everybody how upset I was about difficulties in my life. Maybe Julian knew a bit. Johnny, because Johnny and I were neighbours, we lived a mile away from each other, so we'd see each other every day of the week. So he certainly knew things that were winding me up. Yeah, I just didn't really tend to moan about it, to be quite frank. It's just to run harder at the problem and try and, if there's a problem, go under it, go round it, go over it, go through it, but get through the problem. That was my background. I mean, I was brought up almost on my own, to be quite frank, you know, East London and then Essex. And then, you know, from the age of five, I'd be wandering the streets. It wasn't a protective family environment. You know, I was out on my own. There wasn't an awful lot of parent interaction. There's no violins out here. I'm not sobbing in my teacup. That's how I was brought up. So I don't think I missed anything.
In your prime, do you think you were as good as the other members of the Brit Pack?
Yeah. I mean, there was a hesitation there because I don't want to just sound like an idiot reply again. Of course, you know, I consider each of them as being very, very good racing drivers, you know, but all with slightly different attributes. And there were certain things within my approach where I actually felt maybe I'm a little bit better than anyone, to be quite frank. But there were also flaws.
What were you particularly good at in a racing car?
It seemed to be the rain, yeah, and changing conditions. The only reason I know that is because I was fastest nearly all the time, whether it's testing or whenever it was raining, I was somewhere clear. Johnny would be close, or sometimes John would be a tiny bit quicker, or me faster normally. You know, none of them are mugs in the rain. But I absolutely seemed to be, and this continued in Formula 3000, this certainly continued in America and stuff. But if you ask me why, I'm probably not good enough to identify why. I was doing something. Maybe it was just sheer desperation as well. You know, there needs to be a bit of bravery in the rain, but you can't have bravery above judgment. You know, you've got to understand grip at somewhere. But sometimes one might be tempted to go into a corner a tiny bit slower out of caution. Whereas I was so desperate, maybe I was there and then gathering it all up and finding the grip at the same time. Whatever it was, Tom, that was something that was incredibly important to me. Because a lot of people notice that. And it's one of those things where when you're so desperate, when you've got no money, when the chances are limited, having people of kind of reputation come up to you and just going, I've just seen what you've done, that's amazing. My goodness, what a tonic that is. You know, an arm around the shoulder, somebody giving you some praise when you're in massive debt. You don't know how you're paying next week's bills, and now you're going to go out and beat Damon Hill or whatever the score is, you know? But you have to give something to get that praise. You have to earn it. You have to wave a big white flag out there. I spent a bit of time talking about me there. I should probably talk about the others. Johnny, as an all-rounder, maybe one of the most gifted, naturally gifted racing drivers ever. The guy was amazing.
So as an extension of that, do you think he was the most talented of the Brit Pack at the time?
As an absolute talent, yeah, I think so. Yeah, as a kind of innate talent, yeah, I think so. But there's a lot of factors involved in this game. You know, you go to Damon, you know, some people say, oh, well, anybody could have won in the Williams. Yeah, really? Get in it and win then. Yeah, he won 21, 22 races, Damon. And he didn't do that by being a donkey, you know? He's unbelievably fast. And he's got a mind like a steel trap. Yeah, he can take a load of pressure. He's highly intelligent. All of those combinations together, that makes Damon Hill. If you'd put me in Damon Hill's car, I've got zero idea if I would won as many races. I have zero idea if I would have won the world championship. I just don't know. I have no idea. He had that opportunity. He strangled it, wrung its neck, and delivered. That's what he did. And I'll guarantee you one thing. Crikey, I nearly got soppy there. When he won the world championship, Murray said, "I've got a lump in my throat." Mate, I tell you, so did I. I was absolutely shouting at the TV, just going, "Yes!" Absolutely fantastic. It was the same when John won the Grand Prix, the British Grand Prix and stuff. You know, what Johnny had overcome from his terrible leg injuries. I mean, Johnny used to be around my house of an evening recovering because, as I say, we lived a mile apart. And, oh my God, you know, I'm not kidding you, I could easily well up here. The pain he was suffering and what he came through. And he never complained. It was unbelievable. His level of determination. You look at Marty Donnelly. Is incredibly determined, tricky on track. We used to laugh about that because he could get punchy on track. He really could. Mark, you know, it's like Mark's career speaks for itself. You know, three podiums with cars that probably shouldn't have been there, three IndyCar wins, the Le Mans 24 hours. You know, you're looking at highly, incredibly quick racing drivers. And Julian really never got the recognition he deserved, Julian Bailey, because he was an incredible talent. But Julian's mental approach sometimes wasn't that great in Formula One. I love him to bits, but he's like, that's where we see divisions. And maybe my own mental approach in certain areas wasn't good enough all the time, because I certainly had some off days, and there must have been a reason for that, but I've never been bright enough to work it out. But I definitely had off days. So that's not good enough. You know what I mean? Maybe it needed a lot more behind you to make sure you was more supported. But the problem is I never had that. So there's no answer to it.
This episode is sponsored by Vanta. You know how in Formula One, trust between the team and the driver is everything. Well, it's not so different in business. You need to prove your company is trustworthy to close deals and move forward. But compliance can be a complex and incredibly time-consuming process. Vanta makes it automatic. They help companies show they take security and compliance seriously without drowning in spreadsheets or dragging audits out for months. Whether you're a startup working through your first SOC 2 or ISO 27001, or a bigger team managing vendor risk, Vanta makes the process quicker, simpler, and scalable. You can automate compliance across more than 35 frameworks, fly through security questionnaires up to 5 times faster, and let it all run quietly in the background while you focus on growing your business. According to a recent IDC study, Vanta customers save over $500,000 a year in costs and are 3 times more productive, thanks to its industry-leading AI, automation, and continuous monitoring. Visit vanta.com/grid to sign up for a free demo today. That's vanta.com/grid.
Perry, you're very arty. We're sat in your house. There's a piano in the corner. I'm looking at art from you, from your children. That's quite an unusual background, if you like, for racing drivers. I mean, I can think of Elio De Angelis, of course, who was a concert pianist. And then actually Charles Leclerc, Lewis Hamilton both play the piano today. But it's an arty background as opposed to a sort of an Alonso-type character is very analytical, very mathematical in his approach. Do you think your arty background in any way played against you?
Yeah, but also played for me. No, I get where you're going with that one, is that in debriefs, I could get quite bored fairly quickly. You know, for me, it's like, look, here's the problem. Here's what we need to look at. Concentrate on that. I remember having a row with Richard Lloyd once, when I drove him in the World Championship for Porsche. And he was sitting down with a German driver called Manuel Reuter. And they spent about 25 minutes talking about a 2 mil front packer on the left front spring. And I got up, I said, "See you," I'm going. He said, "Sit down, where are you going?" I said, "I'm bored, this is ridiculous. We're like 5 seconds off the pace and you want to take an hour talking about a packer on the left front spring? This is stupid, I'm not doing it." I got fired from Lotus for the same kind of thing. Yeah, because I just went, this is absolutely a disgrace. You know, they started the engine when we went for a test. And they'd left a Jubilee clip on top of the engine, which had then gone into a cam belt, which had taken it off, which had dropped all the valves into the engine. And then they were trying to tell me that they'd been developing a damper that was 0.05 of a second faster across the lap, when they hadn't managed to develop the braking cooling system for the brakes that were setting the brakes on fire, that meant we couldn't stop. And I just mouthed off and just went, why don't you look at the fact that we can't stop and we're setting light to the brakes, rather than wasting your time.
Do you think, Perry, you were too lippy?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But the problem is that I can't stand what I feel is inefficiency. I can't stand crap, and I'm really bad at taking it. So absolutely, I was not everybody's cup of tea, because it was just stupid, absolute stupidity to me to be burning resources in an area where you could better profit from understanding what is needed. And I'm still like that today in business. Yeah. Where do we get the maximum returns fastest? That's probably the summary to all those stories.
Let's talk about the F1 opportunities now. You test for footwork arrows. Tell us how that opportunity came about first.
Well, it was John Wickham. Yeah.
Who was the team manager at the time.
Yeah. I mean, John wanted me as race driver. So that was his way of trying to get me into the team to then be considered by, really, it was Japanese owners at the time. Jackie Oliver was running the team. And I always had a great deal of respect for Jackie, actually, on what he'd managed to pull together, and especially being a hard nut ex-racing driver as well. But yeah, it was just anything to get me into these cars where I could be looked at, you know. But yeah, at the end of the day, it was great that John felt like that, because he'd been very much on my side for quite a long time. This was his chance to get me in a car. But it didn't matter what I did. Is that it just didn't pass the acid test, you know? Is that the Japanese owners wanted to stick with, it was Alex, I think, Kathy, and Michele.
Michele Alboreto.
Yeah, I mean, all day long, stay with Michele. No problem, you know? Michele was great. Alex, well, I definitely think I had the edge on Alex, you know?
Well, tell us about the test and the impact the car made on you and the sort of job you think you did.
Do you know, I got there for the first ever test, my first ever time in Formula One.
And this is Silverstone.
Yeah, you're right. It was Silverstone. And all of a sudden, I'd never met him before. Michele Alboreto came up to me and said, hey, Perry, welcome to Formula One. I tell you something, you know, there's all this fight coming through. You're punching everybody's lights out and trying to survive and trying to get through, and you end up being like a fairly hard nut to survive all the knocks and everything else. And he said that to me, I could have burst out crying. It meant so much to me. Just thinking, that was so generous of him to even come over, because we'd never met before. And then I sat in the car, it felt like a glove. It felt as if this is where I should have always been. I remember going out from the pit lane and just blatting it immediately. It just felt like it fit.
So this was what, late 1991 or early 92?
No, before that. This was 90. See, this is where America had been so important for me. And I tell you something, you know, while we're talking about those moments of being looked after or embracing, or how important it is to try desperately to stand out on anything, is that back home you had people like Dave Tremaine, Joe Sayward, Tony Dodgins.
These are all journalists.
All the journalists. Everything I did in America, they were making a real meal out of it back in the UK. They really were promoting the fact that I've set another pole, I've led this race, or just glatted away from the field. You know, and it was just going, guys, thank you. You know what you're doing here. You know, this is trying to still keep the energy going. The thing that was against me, Tom, was TikTok, because I'm now, from the time I went to the States, I'm now 29. And so was Damon, actually. Damon's 6 months older than me or something like that. So we're both on TikTok, you know. So it's going, at this rate of progress, I'm going to get into Formula One, but I'm going to be 62 by the time I get there, you know. So having people who were generally perceived to know what they were talking about, backing you up, well, it's great promotion. But as I was saying before, crikey, it makes you feel vindicated, you know. You're kind of thinking, I'm not just standing there barking at the moon, going, oh, honestly, I'm good. You're thinking, somebody else thinks that.
So look, the race opportunity, if we can call it that, comes with Andrea Moda in 1992. Tell us how that opportunity came about.
Bizarre. Absolutely bizarre. What's happening is that I got to the end of 91, and even the little team that I was riding for in the States, they couldn't run me anymore. They'd busted themselves running me financially. So there was no offer for 92. There was no offer from IndyCar for 92 because whoever was interested still needed some kind of sponsorship. So again, I'm on the sidelines. Again, I'm waiting for God knows what, any opportunity whatsoever. And there was a call from Eddie Jordan's solicitor, a guy called Fred Rogers, lovely guy. And Fred said, hello, Perry. He said, I've got a question for you. So I said, yeah. He said, how would you like to be a Formula One driver? So it took me about half a second to reply. I said, yeah, I'd be quite fancy that, Fred.
Is that because you thought Jordan Grand Prix was in the offing?
No, I didn't think that at all. It was just this question. I just went, yeah, but I knew something was in the offing because Fred isn't going to call up and lead with that. So I said, yeah. He said, okay, I think we've got something for you. Can you make it over to see Duffy Shear down, who's heading up this new team called Andrea Moda? And I thought, wow, it sounds great, you know? So I went to see Duffy, and he could see I was looking at him like a saber-toothed tiger, and he was the steak. You know, I was salivating at the time. I always remember Alan Jones saying something once. He put a sheet of paper down and signed it and said to Frank Williams, put whatever you want at the top, you know? And I kind of had the same thing, just saying, I don't care what it is. Just put me in the car. And
I
want to
do it.
I want to do it. So that was it. They signed me up. But then we had all sorts of dramas about the super license because it transpired I actually hadn't done enough racing, you know, because I'd done these two seasons of Formula 3000. Okay, I did stand out in all of those races, but it wasn't enough to get me the super license, which was required back then. So there was a lot of argy-bargy about that. And again, it was pretty much the British press that came to my rescue. But then it was Bernie himself who then started making sure that everybody inside the commission voted for me, and Max Mosley as well. And, you know, so finally I got my super license together, and that was it.
So this is Interlagos. It's race three because the two drivers that started the season have been sacked.
Yeah, you know why they were sacked? It's because the team hadn't even run for those first two races. So the drivers had actually complained to the press about that. So the team fired them.
And that's Alex Caffey and Enrico Bataglia.
Enrico, yeah.
So you're at Interlagos. And at what point in that weekend did you realise there was an issue with the super licence?
It was only the end of the first day. And it was Roland Brunsrider come up to me and said, Perry, what time are you leaving the circuit? And I kind of thought, you can't be that desperate for a dinner date, Roland. I said, why? So he said, I'm going to need your license. And I smelt a rat. And I said, I haven't got it. He said, Perry, give me your license. I said, why? He said, because we've been on the phone to Paris, the FIA, and we've found that you haven't done enough racing. The license was issued in error. La-di-da-di-da. So I had to give him the license back. I borrowed the money to actually fly to Brazil. And, you know, when I was there, Ken Tyrrell came up to the garage and beckoned me out and just gave me a big hug and said, welcome to Formula One. And I just went, wow, this is Ken saying that, you know, and this happened up and down the pit lane. But Ken was the first, you know. And so all that elation and all these years and everything that had happened to get there. And then this prat comes along and puts my license back. You go, Christ, I haven't even driven yet. You know, give me a chance to smash the thing up or take somebody out before you take the license away. But
so that of course, was it. So Roland Brunsrider was FISA, FIA.
I felt sorry for Roland because I absolutely, he was only doing his job, but I absolutely launched at Roland. He got it left, right and centre, you know, because I was so upset.
And did Bernie Eccleston help?
Yeah, I went to see Bernie the following day. He said, sit down. He said, right. They've told me you're a fighter, because obviously he'd forgotten he'd even met me and I wasn't going to bring it back up. I said, yes, Bernie. He said, right, bang, bang, bang. So anyway, he said, right, senor, what you need to do, you need to go and speak to these representatives. You bring me Ron Dennis, Frank Williams, Giancarlo Minardi, Marco Piccinini, who was the lawyer at Ferrari, and Flavio
Briatore.
He said, they are all members of the F1 commission. I'll vote for you. Max will vote for you. I'll bring you the rest. So I've gone, right, okay, so that's my deal. I'll go see Ron. I'll go see Frank. I'll go see Giancarlo. So most of them should be okay, you know? It's Flav, I didn't know, that was it. But this is Gotthard Ischgl. We got to the door, and suddenly the door's open. Bernie's gone, oh, and I can't remember the guy's name, but let's call him Guido. Oh, Guido. Bernie's looked at me and he said, Barry, by chance, this is Guido. He's a member of the Sao Paulo. He said, and he is on the commission for the Formula One because I needed all the votes from the Formula One commission for me to get my license. So all these people needed to vote for me to have a super license, yeah? So he's looked at Guido. He said, Guido, he said, by chance, this is Mr. McCarthy. He said, oh, hello, Mr. McCarthy. He said, Guido, Mr. McCarthy has a small problem. He said, I know. He said, so Guido, if I asked you to vote for him, how would you vote? So Guido, of course, is standing there now paralyzed with fear. And he's just looking at Bernie going, oh my God, what do I say? So he's come out with what he thought would be sounding good. And he said, well, Mr. Ecclestone, I would return to my committee to have a consensus of opinion to see what they said. And Bernie's gone, no. And you see Guido go, oh shit. He's gone, I would talk to the press and see what they said about Mr. McCarthy. He said, no. And Guido's like, I'm actually enjoying this. Even in my situation, I'm actually getting some fun out of this. I'm just looking, going, I'm fascinated by this. And Bernie's looked at him and he said, look, Guido, let me help you with this. I want you to vote for him. He said, no problem. And I'm standing there. And Bernie's looked at me and he's gone, there's another vote. So then I went straight to see Ron. Ron wanted to take me through his freight problems that he had before listening to me and everything else. That was it. Frank, yeah, straight on board. So Ron, Frank, Giancarlo, just, I didn't know him very well, but that was all fine. I can't remember who it was. It wasn't Nicky who introduced me to Marco Piccinini, a Ferrari, but that all went well. But Flavio, when I met Flavio, he looked at me as if I was some kind of something on a Piri dish that scientists looked at and just went, ugh. What are you? I always remember that thinking, oh, I'm really enjoying this knot, you know?
But you got his vote.
Yeah, well, somehow he just decided. I think he maybe handed it over to Gordon Message or Pat Simmons or whatever it was. But one of those people, I think, convinced him. Gordon Message was team manager at the time and Pat was engineer. So one of those inside the team probably said, no, Perry should be in F1. But I don't think it's ever happened like that or since. I think I'm the only driver that's ever been awarded a super license by the entire Formula One commission voting in my favour. Do you know something? After saying that, maybe Kimi, because Kimi came in
straight from Formula Renault.
Mm. So maybe Kimi had that same situation as well.
So you get the license,
yeah,
but actually you didn't have a car. You didn't turn a wheel in Brazil.
In Brazil, it wasn't finished. The car wasn't finished to go out on track.
And so the team boss, Andrea Sassetti, had bought the remnants of the Coloni Formula One team at the end of the previous season.
I think he got turned over fairly badly on that deal.
Well, just how big was the team? Or was it a similar size to a Formula 3000 team? Just how small was it?
I mean, incredibly small. And funny enough, in order to actually get the cars finished, it looked like a Formula One recruiting office of a nighttime because other teams were moonlighting. They would be there in Williams or Brabham shirts or whatever, putting the cars together to help get the cars together to go out to the first races. The base to begin with was in the UK, but then it returned to Ancona, which is out in Italy.
Well, let's talk about the first time you drive it. You're in Barcelona, it's the Spanish Grand Prix. It was frustrating. Just you're trying to pre-qualify the car. What happened?
Well, I got out to Spain, clearly, of course, the day before the dreaded Friday morning, because we were on track at 8 o'clock in the morning. They still hadn't completed the car. So I'm standing there trying to do the right thing. And by this time, of course, I've been issued with a super license. So I'm back there and everybody's, you know, it's really nice. And now I'm looking forward to going out and, you know, going around Barcelona and going as fast as I can. And that's it. Anyway, I've hung around, and it's got to like 10:30 at night, and I'm thinking, well, Christ, I'm supposed to be out on the track at 8 in the morning. I do need to get back to the hotel. So finally, Andrea agreed to let somebody drive me across Barcelona. Anyway, I've pulled into my luxury, because I'm now a Formula One superstar, of course. So I've pulled into my hotel expecting wonders and riches, and I've opened the door, and the room that I was staying in had about 7 beds in it. So it was me and the team all staying in the same room. I'm laughing. I couldn't give a monkey's. So I put my head down. And of course, the team were coming back. So I'm going to go in with the team, you know. Woke up in the morning and I can see daylight piercing through these kind of paper thin curtains and stuff like that. I've looked around the room. I've gone, oh my God, there's nobody in the room. Nobody in the room. I've called down to reception. I said, what's the time? They said, 7:30.
And you're meant to be on the track
on
at 8 a.m.
At 8. And I don't know where I am. And I've got washed and dressed faster than Superman, believe me. I've run down the stairs. I'm in a complete panic. How professional am I? You know, my first Grand Prix, I'm not even going to turn up. You know, it's all gone wrong. I'm standing there going, oh my God, how can I get a car? How can I get a car? Nobody was helping. I swear to you, in walked Andrea's brother. And believe me, he just got back from a nightclub. And I said, I've got to get to the track. He said, come with me, in Italian. So I've shot out. They chose the wrong driver. They should have signed him. This guy was mental. We were flat out across Barcelona. Food lights, everything else. Bam, bam, bam. We've pulled up outside the paddock. He's absolutely killed this car to get me there. I've just looked at him. It's like the devil incarnate. I've just run through the paddock, straight to the back of the truck, got changed, run down. The press is standing there thinking, what's going on? Because it was bang on 8 o'clock. My heart is at 200 beats a minute. I've jumped in the car, strapped down and everything else. They can't get the car started. So they've sprayed loads of quick start into the air in it. Loads and loads and loads and loads and loads. And I'm exaggerating this. And actually, I'm pushing the point here because of the next thing that happened. So much so that when they've started the engine, the whole thing is ignited inside the airbox. And a tunnel of flame has come out around my head and around the cockpit, right? Which they've then thrown blankets over me to try and put it out. They've lifted the blankets off, got the engine going, and they've gone, okay, go. Now, when we talk about today's modern Grand Prix drivers and how professional they are and with the levels of backup and comfort that they've got, basically, I've had my own version of Home Alone. I've nearly been killed in multiple crashes across Barcelona to get there. I've sat in the car. They've very nearly incinerated me. And it's now time to go out and try and qualify for my first ever Grand Prix.
Perfect prep.
Perfect prep.
Not.
I've pulled out of the garage. I've got to the line. I'm trying to calm down. My heart's on valve bounce, you know, like that. And they've gone, go. And I've gone across the line and the engine's cut out. And the car's rolled to a halt. And that was it. And I told you, Tom, as soon as I came into Formula One, I would set records. I told everybody that, and I did. The shortest ever attempt at qualifying for a Grand Prix, I think it was 30 meters. And I got out the car, and you just look in. And I remember looking up, and there was part of me that was laughing, just going, I just can't believe this. Before we began the interview, you reminded me of something that I've always said, which is very nice of you, is that I actually understand success, which is great. I actually completely understand failure, unfortunately. But what I don't understand is mediocrity. Even looking back at this level of failure, it wasn't about being mediocre. It was about trying in stupid circumstances, ridiculous circumstances. So it's probably helped that I'm actually not a bitter person. I swear to you, when asked about this, if there was a key attribute, I'm going to be big-headed and say it and offer it up. I have never been jealous of anybody in my entire life about anything. Nothing. Zero. I always believe it's out there for you to get or not get. That's all there is to it. I'm kind of the same about my own career. That's what I was saying earlier about that kind of hard dumb boy thing. I don't look at it like that. It went wrong. Tough. Brush yourself down, pick yourself up, get going again. And I look back at even these mental things that happen and start laughing and just go, oh my God. And I think that what happened with all this nonsense is that incredibly, we became so remembered for how bad it was. We weren't just, I was out there 15th, 16th on the grid as a fairly solid midfielder and finished my career like that. I was probably more all or nothing, you know? I kind of think I was destined to either maybe do terribly well or the career I had.
But did you believe at this stage that it was going to get better?
Well, to be quite honest, you can't help but think it's going to get a bit better from that. You know, yeah. I mean, we are talking fairly low levels there, you know? So if you couldn't imagine it getting better from that, I think that you'd probably be a fairly sad individual. Funny thing is, it didn't get an awful lot better from there. But at that point, you're thinking, okay, well, we're getting some of the teething trouble out the way. You know, there's got to be an opportunity here somewhere.
You go to Imola next, and actually you complete 7 laps. Okay, you don't qualify, but did you start to get a feel for the car's potential?
No, not really. I mean, the first couple of laps were even learning which way the corners went, and then I started getting an awful lot faster. But immediately I picked up that we had so much understeer because the diff was binding. I kind of could feel that immediately, and I came in to tell them, and that was it. They said they couldn't do anything about it, and that was it. That was my sum total of trying to qualify at Imola, those 7 laps. It was really lucky I'd maintained my fitness for that, because that was, by my Andrea Moda standards, that was an endurance event.
Can we talk about Monaco? And actually,
I was frightened.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why?
I often get asked about fear in motor racing, and Ayrton said something, which is really cool. It encapsulates it. You know, he said, yeah, of course he has fear. Yeah, you know, in my opinion, everybody has fear. They're either lying or they're not going fast enough if they've said they've never been frightened. As Ayrton used to put it, you have to squeeze that fear down and you've got to try and somehow be in control of it. And I totally subscribe to that, because I've had all those moments where it's pouring rain, you can't see anything. And clearly, of course, your heart beats at 700 beats a minute. You know, it's like you're tingling about what can go wrong, but you're pushed to do it. But normally that fear lasts for a very small moment in time. They put me out of Monaco, and I'd never been around Monaco before. And I know the bloody thing isn't going to last that long. And they put me out late in the session. The seat wasn't fitting. There was no windshield. The steering column was moving. I was being bounced around all over the place, trying to push as hard as I could just on those few laps. My head was getting smacked around everywhere because there was no shield. I was straight in full on air to do it. And as I say, the column was moving, and I couldn't feel the car because the seat was moving and I wasn't fitting in the seat properly. And I can tell you quite seriously, that was very different from being scared for a moment. I was actually frightened. And you're thinking, do you know something? I'm probably in the wrong place here. You know, I'm completely out of my depth, totally out of my depth. I'm in this thing that it's still a Formula One car, even though it's a piece of junk. So it's still quick, but I'm moving in the seat. I can't steer it properly. My head's being smacked around all over the place, and I've never seen the circuit before. And I've got 1 or 2 laps to try and qualify it. There was a nagging doubt inside me thinking, you know, this is where that absolute killer drive to even come through my career, coupled with what was now happening, was probably going to get me killed, because I just could not control the whole thing. And I guess where I was particularly lucky is that they had put me out so late that there was no time to complete anything. So then I came back into the pits. I was going around there just going, I don't know what I'm doing. And I've never, ever had that. It was too much. I just couldn't do it.
Did you feel the team... Okay, it had 2 cars. You were in one. Roberto Moreno was in the other. But did you feel actually it was a 1-car team?
No, totally. Yeah, I mean, Roberto makes no bones about it. Looking from Roberto's side of things, Roberto was absolutely right for him and maybe for the team to direct them as he did, which is to say, don't bother about the second car. You're incapable of running a second car. Put all the resources into my first car. So... from Roberto's position, he was totally right to do that. Even from the team's position, he was right to do that. What you've got as being the second driver in that situation is a pile of junk, and actually quite a dangerous one. Yeah, I'm not desperately keen on Roberto as a person, but he was totally right to do what he did from his perspective, and indeed from the team's perspective. Where the team were wrong is that they did have a duty of care to actually keep me alive. And I don't say that lightly, because as I hope you know, I don't moan and I don't dramatize, but that was getting marginal. And I mean really marginal.
The fact that Moreno qualified that car at Monaco, did that tell you at some level that if they could get your car up and running, it was a decent car?
Tom, I know where you're going with this. That was nothing to do with the team. The only thing that team managed to do to get that car to qualify was the fact that it kept running for a few laps. There's one thing that got that car into Monaco, and that was Roberto. That's the only thing that got that car in. And I'll tell you something. I reckon if qualifying had gone on for another two or three laps, Roberto wouldn't have got in, because there were a bunch of newcomers at Monaco then. I think that they were still learning the track and understanding what to do and everything else. Whereas Roberto knew Monaco, very fast racing driver, and managed to haul that thing around the track. But the others were getting better and better and better, clearly probably with better cars. So another one or two laps, they would have had their confidence with a better car to displace Roberto. So no, my personal opinion is the only thing that got that car into the race was the fact that it carried on running for a few laps, which was a real achievement. See, I told you it'd get better. And Roberto doing a super job to get the car in.
This episode is sponsored by Shopify. If you've shopped online, chances are you've bought from a business powered by Shopify. You know that purple Shop Pay button at checkout? The one that makes buying so incredibly easy? That's Shopify. And there's a reason so many businesses use it. Because Shopify makes it so simple to start and run your business. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from major names like Mattel and Gymshark to small brands just getting started. It's the go-to platform for millions of businesses worldwide. And what's great about Shopify is that it gives you a leg up from day one. You can build your storefront using hundreds of beautiful, ready-to-go templates, and there's zero coding required. Plus, you can manage everything in one place, from inventory to payments to analytics. And when it comes to marketing, Shopify has you covered there as well, with its inbuilt marketing and emails tools designed to help you spread the word about your brand. Oh, and that iconic purple Shop Pay button. It's not just popular, it's the best converting checkout on the planet. Your customers already love it. If you want to see fewer carts being abandoned, it's time for you to head over to Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/beyondthegrid. Go to shopify.com/beyondthegrid. shopify.com/beyondthegrid.
So the team goes from Monaco, where they qualify one car, and then the next five races are messy, right? You have Canada, where there were freight issues. There was no engine for your car in Montreal. You then go to France and the trucks didn't arrive at Manicourt because there was a truck driver's strike. They got caught up in that. Silverstone, your home Grand Prix, you're put out on Roberto's used wet tyres on a dry track.
Yeah, I thought that was even cool for the team to come up with that one. I went out there and just went, I'm fed up with this crap, you know. And I set the fastest time on my first lap, yeah. Then the next lap, you know that thing I said to you about Monaco, where I was lucky that we got put out so late so that they called me in? I got really lucky at Silverstone because I had completely had enough. I was absolutely hell-bent on those tyres, in those conditions, on just keeping my foot in. And the clutch went the following lap. The problem is that you stop asking yourself the questions you should be asking because you're so desperate to try and go through. But for a team to do that to you, to put you out in those circumstances, and then your own mentality, just say, I'm staying, I'm keeping my foot in anyway on the following lap, that was going to get walled big time. And so I got lucky that the clutch went. So I couldn't be stupid enough to push because I had lost my temper, which was dumb. I told you, these are one of my many flaws.
Did you think of quitting at this moment?
No, never.
You're not a quitter?
No. That wasn't even on the cards.
What about when you go to Hungary at the next race and they put you out with, I think, 45 seconds of pre-qualifying to go?
I came back from that one, went into the garage, and I was about to punch everybody in the team. Yeah, so there was a big hold back, and that was it, because I'd completely lost it. And the amazing thing was, it was about an hour before that, Jackie Oliver had come up to me and just said, Perry, would you consider testing for the team at Spa, i.e. Arrows, you know? We want to test you and everything else. Well, the thing is, I knew Spa was coming up. I knew the circuit. I knew the conditions might rain. So even in the Andrea Moda, around Spa, I might get that on the grid. So I said to Jackie, I can't. That's it. But I'll talk to Andrea after qualifying to see if they can loan me out to you to do the test. Well, of course, they sent me out with 45 seconds. I've come in throwing a wobbler after punching everybody out. Funny enough, Andrea didn't actually concede to my request to be released to Arrows after that. So I shot myself in the foot there.
Was that the moment you think that you kissed goodbye to a Formula One career?
No. I was getting a lot of people coming up to me in Formula One saying, I cannot believe what you're going through and that you're still that determined. So I've probably set the scene on I'm not trusting the team technically or from their level of skill or devotion to me or application to me, pardon me, that would be a better word.
Spa is actually the last race, if you look at the record books, that you try and qualify.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
Here's where we were in the clear, because the Brabham team were in so much trouble back then. I don't think they turned up for that race. So that meant there was no need for pre-qualifying anymore. So we are for the first time going to be in qualifying. That's it. In the right conditions, I could get this bloody thing on the grid. I've done it before, you know, that's it. But I know I'm not going to have long to do it. So I went out on the track and wallop. I'm just going to trust myself. Just go natural. Find out what the thing does and play with it as I go. But it's got to be fast now. And my first run down to Eau Rouge, I was flat, obviously. You know, flat means flat out. So you're changing gear, you're flat out on the throttle. And I've come up to begin my turn in. Now, of course, a Formula One car gets heavier at speed because of the downforce, you know. But I've gone to turn in and the steering was really, I mean, really difficult. Now, if it had been, I swear to you, if it had been any other car, I would have stayed flat. Yeah, and just thought, I'll take care of it. But a warning bell went off in my head and just went brake. And by the time I was on the brakes, I was in the middle of the corner at the bottom of the hill. And I couldn't turn the car. The steering wheel were jammed. This is one of those things that I don't know what I was doing, but sometimes I do the right thing. It's just gut feeling. And I came off the brakes. Now, what that did was it lifted the car. I turned the steering wheel. It was incredibly difficult to do so. I went off the track along the wall, but not in. I turned the car rather than straight in, where you know how the wall faces you. I'd gone up the hill, over the brow, and I'd made it. That was very, very close. Because even in an Andrea Modi, you're coming into that about 180 miles an hour. You know, and the wall was facing me and the steering wheel wouldn't turn. So I'd got away with it. Now I'm so much slower at the top of the hill, I've turned and the car's turning. So then I've gone a bit faster, steering wheel's jammed. And I said to myself, downforce, jamming, steering rack's flexing. So imagine the steering rack as being a hollow tube which allows the passage of the steering arms to come through. Once you turn the steering wheel, the steering column, it drags the steering arms in. Well, if that is bent, it won't allow the steering arms to come in, therefore freezing the steering column and the steering wheel. So that was it for me. I was right. So I crawled back to the pits. I came into the pits. I just said, guys, I think the steering rack is jamming. And I said, we know. I said, right, how do you know that? And there were journalists around. Tony Dodgins was there. Tony Dodgins, just before I got in the car, begged me not to get in the car, the journalist, the F1 journalist. He said, I've got a horrible feeling. I said, I've got no choice, Tony. I've got to go. So they were around there when I was doing this. And I said, so sorry, you knew that the steering rack was flexing? Yeah. We tested it on Roberto's car last week. So what you did, guys, is you took the steering rack off that car that was flexing and you put it on my car for qualifying for the Belgium Grand Prix. Yeah. Well, that's when I knew that it was time to leave the team. But I didn't even have a chance because word about this got around and other things as well, and the team were actually banned. This is where you look back at these things and just go, how do I take that? Well, I take it as like, am I a lucky boy or what? Unbelievably lucky. Not unlucky to have been in the car, not unlucky to have got to Formula One, not unlucky about the opportunity that dissolved. Lucky boy that didn't end up ploughed into the wall.
Driving back from Spa on that Saturday evening, did you think you'd ever drive a Formula One car again?
I wasn't prepared to stop fighting at that time. I knew that that wasn't me. I knew that that wasn't me having lost my nerve. I was rather hopeful that from literally only 9-10 months before leading stuff in America, that I hadn't lost any speed or desire or talent or anything like that. So you felt there's got to be a way in. But I had kind of focused all my ambitions so much on Formula One that I'd actually really neglected any other kind of career in motor racing, including what we call Group C, you know, the big Le Mans World Championship sports cars, etc. Everything was quite ruthlessly aimed at Formula One. So it was pretty much Formula One or nothing.
Are there parallels at this time between you and what Damon Hill was going through? Because he was in the Brabham, they were in financial difficulties. I would imagine Damon was wondering whether the F1 break was really going to happen for him.
Yeah, I imagine Damon was wondering that, because even though Damon's car and his team were a joke compared to, of course, the illustrious years of Brabham 10 years before, you know, the car could do something, but it really wasn't quick enough. So pretty much Damon was failing to pre-qualify as well. And we got to spend a lot of nice time together across the Grand Prix weekend while the others were really working hard. But what Damon did have behind him at that same time was that he had got the Williams testing contract. So back in those days, when testing was allowed and required, Damon was doing an awful lot of laps and an awful lot of work with a top Grand Prix team to understand what makes a car better, how he can fit into that, develop his own skills, his own communication with the team, all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, there was the most unusual set of circumstances for Damon, that at the end of 92, having, of course, had a not quite as bad as my own showing, but pretty bad showing. You know, this wasn't going to make his career driving for Brabham, full stop. Yeah, he was probably over, to be quite frank. Same as me. You know, there's not too many chances available. But the thing is, Nigel left the Williams team, as you know, after winning the World Championship. So he'd had this big spat with the team, throwing the toys out the pram, I'm leaving, that's it. And it was so late in the year that they're going, well, all the other top stars are signed. But Damon, where his work had given him such credibility, is that he'd done such a great job that he made it an easier decision for them to make that leap to say, okay, we're going to upgrade our test driver to be race driver. If he'd just been plonking around in the Williams all through the year without anything special, there's no way they would have made that jump. But that's what this game and many things are about, opportunity and being prepared for them. And he was. So there was that opportunity, he jumped in, grabbed it, and of course made the most of it.
Was there a lesson there for you about going the testing route?
Well, I tried pushing Williams for a test drive. I tried pushing everybody to get in for a regular test ride, but many of them already had their test drivers anyway. And the other thing is, you know, I certainly had my fans out there, but you know, each year you get older, you're becoming less and less attractive. Because remember, now I was in Formula One with Andrea Moda, but I was 31. Really and truly, I would kind of fight in the F1 team's corner against me, if you like, and just say, well, why do we want to take on a third driver when we could maybe find a real young superstar at 21, 22, 23, who we could have under contract for another 5, 6, 7 years and do better from there? So that's just really the kind of facts of life, you know?
You do get to test for a front-running team later in 1992 when you jump into the Benetton.
Oh, yeah.
How revealing was that experience?
You know, there's certain things about that that were kind of tiny bit upsetting. I went pretty quickly in that car, and it was really didn't take much to do it. Working with great people in a great car, having that real confidence that, my God, I've got something under me. You know, I didn't go instantly quick within the first 5 laps because my total lappage had been like 10, 12 laps that year. So I needed to get a tiny bit of confidence around, because it felt like being strapped to the back of an Exocet once you got in this bloody thing, because it'd been a while since I'd driven something so great. But, you know, at the end of the first day, I kind of got started getting my head around it and went quicker and quicker, which was fantastic. So that confidence is the, and this is what I was saying before about even the top drivers need that arm around the shoulder, need some backup, need some confidence from people around them. And my goodness, it worked. But I only got the drive because Alex Zanardi, back when Alex was third driver, was ill for a little while. So I tested for Benetton's for a little while. That was great. And it was brilliant. But yeah, I liken the third driver role sometimes to being like reminds me of Jungle Book. You know, you remember the vultures that are sitting on the tree? You know, you're sitting around just waiting for somebody to get hurt or ill or anything to jump in their seat. But that situation didn't transpire for me. But that came up because Marty Brundle recommended me to get in, you know, when they needed a driver.
And that B192 was the car in which Schumacher had won his first race in Belgium earlier in the year.
Yeah.
Were you testing alongside Michael?
No, because I was testing the active ride suspension.
Ready for the following season?
Yeah. So they didn't want Michael in the car because it had a habit of going wrong sometimes. And, you know, you don't want your star player getting hurt and that's it. So anyway, Michael was down there and I'd been going around and by now I'm going bloody quickly. But, you know, I'm looking at the times on thinking, okay. So I said to Michael, well, how do you drive the lap? So he took me around the lap and everything else. And I said, yeah, me too. And bridge corner, I take flat out. That's my German accent, by the way, okay? At bridge corner, I take flat out. I say, no. I'm trying to take that flat and I can't get anywhere near it. He said, I take it flat out. So I've gone back out in the car and it's really wound me up. And I'm going out there and I'm now approaching bridge corner and I'm thinking, okay, I know you're brilliant, but if you can take it flat out, so can I. But everything inside me is going, I can't take this flat out. I've already tried and the car's moving way too much. But I've stuffed my foot in the accelerator and I'm just turning in. That's it. Well, I've turned in. This is what I mean about my level of intelligence. It's like wanting, you know? The car's gone everywhere. My hands were moving faster than Bruce Lee in a kung fu fighting film.
Did you spin?
No, I didn't spin. There was no doubt a bit of skill going on there. There was undoubtedly a massive dollop of luck going on. And I kept the thing together and managed to get through the next corners. Scared the daylights out of myself because you don't want to be wrecking the Benetton as this. Here's your chance. Oh, by the way, he's just totaled Michael's car. Great stuff. So I've come straight into the pits and I'm thinking, it's got to be something wrong. It's got to be tire pressures. I'll say that. So I've come in. Pat Simmons has come up to the car. I said, why are you in? I said, Pat, I said, can we check the tire pressures? I think there's something wrong. He said, okay. Anyway, he's gone for a little while later. He's come back. He's kneeling down by the car and he's got a smile on his face. And he's gone, so, Pell, did you have a little moment out there? So I said, no, not at all. He said, you sure about that? I said, yep, because I don't want to show weakness. You know, I don't want to show that. He said, really? He said, well, the funny thing is, he said, on the telemetry trace, we've got you on full opposite lock, 180 miles an hour, right? So I've gone, well, it's not me, it was Michael. Michael said he could take bridge flat. And I said, right, well, I will as well. He said, Michael does take it flat when he's got no fuel in the car and he's on qualifying tyres. You were on used race rubber with half a tank of fuel. So, yeah, obviously Michael totally wound me up to do that. I don't know if he even realised what he was doing, but that was me being an idiot. But there again, that's the competitive drive. You know, I was thinking, I can't understand from what he's just said how he can be that much quicker. But I should have trusted myself.
Well, Perry, it's an incredible story. Yours. If I were to say to you, what is the biggest thing you learnt in Formula One? What's your answer?
Do you know, I've got a different reply to that. It's probably going to sound stupid, but it's not a one-way street. Those things I said to you about earlier, that I felt I had some attributes which were right for Formula One, I actually do believe that. That level of focus, that level of desire, passion, the culture of work ethic, the culture of that curiosity. How can we be better? How can we want more? How can we get more, you know, with a direction involved in it? But I have an awful lot of people contact me on a fairly regular basis. And it's really sweet and often brings a lump to my throat, is that people have got hold of me and they've had a really bad time in life or something like that. And they've read my book and they've seen my own attitude to it, including how to laugh stuff off or keep punching and stuff like that. And they've said it's made a difference to them. And that really affects me greatly, because if you feel that you've given anything to people, not just from an entertainment position, from them wanting to see a racing driver and go out and race cars, but maybe if some people have taken, you know, your own attitude and it's maybe helped them, I think that's the biggest thing that I could ever ask for. That means probably more to me than getting a few podiums or something like that. That ongoing thing that where you just keep getting that feedback from people. So I kind of will be big-headed and turn around and say, you know, maybe I did get a lot from Formula One. Maybe I learned some stuff from Formula One. But I rather hope I've actually contributed my bit to Formula One to enhance the culture, the reputation of Formula One, of saying, this is what Formula One takes. People like this who are just won't stop. I rather hope that I might, even with my stunningly successful career in Formula One, but I was around it for a real long time, you know, even before I got in, people knew about me and I'd often be in the pits and stuff like that. So I do feel as if my Formula One time wasn't just that year. People knew about me in Formula One for a real long time before and slightly after as well. So I can only hope that for a change, maybe a slightly different answer to you, maybe one that you don't receive, is that I have, honest to God, hope that I've given my share back to maintaining Formula One's reputation as a place of just absolute level of determination, you know?
Well, that's a hell of a legacy. But as you as a racing driver,
yeah,
if you had your time again, what would you do differently?
Not start. What I did differently? Oh, do you know what? There's been plenty of times when I wish I could have kept my mouth shut. But conversely, that's the fire that is within me. The problem is that when you're so used to coming out punching because there's nobody around you, you don't know any other way to react. I didn't have an upbringing or an entry into this game with people looking after you.
Would you have got a manager?
Again, the problem was is that when and who would I have listened to at that particular moment in time? I wasn't kind of on those levels. I wasn't bright enough to actually understand that somebody could have taken care of me in that way. Who would have paid for the manager? There was no money. You can't have a manager just pick you up and run with you who's any good if they're not getting any money. So it kind of, you know, you might as well say, would you have enjoyed joining Williams when you was 26? Yes. You know, but the reality is that to a degree, this was my lot. And even that was only made possible was because I refused to take no for an answer on so many levels coming through. Was I right on every level? Bloody well not. How many mistakes did I make on and off track? Loads and loads and loads. Did I maximize certain moments to really stand out? Yes. And that's how I stayed in the game. But my entire story is with shortfalls from my side, no question. Also from some bad luck, to be quite frank. But on some other things, I probably made my own bad luck. Do I have loads and loads of regrets? I tell you, God's honest truth, Tom, no. I've had some brilliant times, really brilliant times. There have been some great successes, some wonderful friendships, which are still intact today. And unlike what could have happened at Eau Rouge, I'm still alive and kicking, enjoying a bottle of wine every now and again and watching my kids fulfill their aspirations and dreams as well. So all in all, it's been a ride. That word, proud of the friendships, probably proud of the book, what it means to me, what it's meant to other people, that will stay. That will stay as, let's say, Perry's legacy. And hopefully people can pick up on a bit of humour.
And one door shuts, another one opens.
Yes.
Very briefly, you were the first Stig on the BBC TV show Top Gear. That looked amazing fun. I did want to ask, what was the fastest car you got to drive in that role?
The Stiggy stuff was incredible. I mean, keeping it secret absolutely works. You know what it's like when people don't know something and they really want to know? And the question of who is the Stig became one of the top 10 questions asked on the internet. And I was just behind, is there a God and am I pregnant? And then who is the Stig? That was amazing. Fastest car, yeah, it was the Bacani Zonda or the Koenigsegger or whatever. But yeah, they're quick, but obviously it's not a racing car. Obviously, I'm going to get in something and go as fast as I can. There wasn't that reward of being a racing driver. Nothing is.
And who was the best celebrity you coached in, what was it, the reasonably priced car?
Go back to that conversation we had about the Rat Pack, about different attributes. On sheer absolute speed, you know, but raw kind of pace, was JK from Jamiroquai. However, probably better than him as an overall thing was actually Jodie Kidd, the supermodel, because Jodie was thinking ahead and she was keeping it smooth, still with a pace, on sheer absolute raw speed in those cars, not quite where Jay was, but as somebody who could develop probably further, if she went further, would have been Jodie Kidd.
Perry, it has been a wonderful chat. Thank you so much for your time. I did just want to end with this. It is the 75th anniversary of Formula One in 2025. What is your favourite race in the history of F1?
75 years is incredible for this kind of sport, isn't it? Because it's been so full of drama, so full of stories, so full of characters, so full of talent. I guess for me, those closing laps in the 1979 Dijon Grand Prix between Gilles Villeneuve and René Arnoux, you know, Jaboui in the lead Renault was off on his own winning a race. But my goodness, the battle royale between those two. And that showed the talent, the commitment, the passion, and breathtaking excitement for the crowd and for the viewers. It was just unbelievable.
It was an awesome battle. And it was for P2, not even for the win. It does beg the question, actually. Gilles Villeneuve, your helmet colours look very like his. Was he a hero of yours?
Yeah, I had it done in Gilles's colours. It celebrated kind of my entry into Formula One. You know, you take specific moments about those driving moments about saying, why did you become a Grand Prix driver? And one of those things was looking at Gilles Villeneuve on the track and people like Alan Jones and Jody Scheckter and things like that. But Gilles, of course, was that kind of gifted, exciting thing. And you just thought, wow, I wonder if I could be like him. So it'd been almost exactly 10 years since Gilles was killed in qualifying at Zolder, Belgium, in 1982. And all those things just fit to just turn around and say, I'm going to have my crash helmet in Gilles's colours. You know, there is that romance inside me. You know, for years and years and years, I would meet another racing driver who was very famous and well-known, and I'd be standing there, and I'd have to remind myself, I'm a racing driver too, but inside I'm thinking, wow, I'm standing with Alan Jones. Wow, Keke Rosberg's talking to me, you know? And I never lost that sense of awe. And still some of the people I still see in Formula One and stuff, I meet them, and inside I'm thinking, wow, I'm speaking to, you know, him or
the little boy in you coming out.
Honest to God, it's still there. Yeah. Very much still there. And I get some of that kick from watching, you know, Formula One still, just going, wow, what a move. Great one. Go, 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 you know?
Perry, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you.
Dijon 79 was one of the all-time great races, and that battle in the closing laps between Villeneuve and Arnoux was inspirational. It stirred something in Perry and in millions of others around the world. And as for Perry, his story is one of guts and determination. Against all odds, he made it as a racing driver and he made it to Formula One. A career trajectory like his simply couldn't happen today, which makes it all the more remarkable. Thanks for sharing it, Perry, and thank you for your time. I hope to see you again soon. Well, that's almost it for this week. One more thing before I go. Martin Donnelly's name came up a few times in this chat, and Brad Pitt also mentioned him when I spoke to him about F1 the movie. He was the inspiration for Sonny Hayes' character in the film. So do scroll back on the Beyond the Grid feed or search for our episode with Martin for another incredible F1 story from the 1990s. I'll of course be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. But for now, thanks for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.